Journalism is under assault in the Philippines. Maria Ressa is an award-winning reporter and the founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of Rappler.com, an independent voice of news in that country. A couple of months ago, she was named one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year for her courage in continuing to publish independent journalism in the face of what can only be called government harassment. 2 weeks ago, she was arrested on charges of cyber libel based on a story that came out 7 years ago, before that law was even on the books. In full disclosure, I've known Maria for more than 20 years. We were colleagues together at CNN in Asia. And I've also had the honor of doing some work with some of the fine journalists at Rappler.com, both in Manila and in Tacloban in the Philippines, which was struck several years ago by a devastating cyclone. I started a call with Maria by asking her about the extent of government interference into the news coverage she and her team are doing.
It's clear there's abuse of power in this and that the state's resources are behind the kind of political intimidation and harassment that I didn't really feel as much when we were with CNN, right? But it's a brave new world, and all of this is partially enabled by technology, the kind of social media propaganda machine that the government has had, as well as the law, you know, other resources of the government that it's bringing to bear on against reporters. It's a kind of a crazy time right now.
You were in the Philippines at the fall of Marcos, the rise of Cory Aquino revolution in the Philippines. It's unfair to ask in terms of a comparison, but it's also a natural question.
I mean, it's a little bit like Back to the Future, right? Ironically, like the Sunday before the week I was arrested, I was going back over the FOIA documents in the United States and the CIA briefings for the president, the sitting president at that time, and I was reading the descriptions that they were giving about the Philippines shortly after martial law was declared. And what's fascinating to me, and I used this in one of my newsletters, is that if you take the words that they were using to describe the situation and to describe the reaction of the people, that in many instances, even in 1973, that Filipinos actually welcomed martial law because they felt it was a restoration of law and order. It's the same narrative that's being used today, that it is that the government must have a strong hand, that it needs to be that this drug war is necessary. It's also admitted to the brutal killings of thousands of Filipinos. Interesting to note, the government today, the police admits killing at least 5,000 people in the 21 years that Marcos was in power. The casualty toll at that point was 3,200 less in 9 years, in 21 years, right, than it is today.
And what is the broader sense about the environment for news in the Philippines? What's life like in your newsroom day to day?
Gosh, there's no one thing. I think, you know, it's like in many instances depends on the escalation of government actions. And what we do is we try to get ahead of it. We're still doing the stories. I think that's the most important part. We need to stay focused because all of these actions are meant to take our focus away from our jobs. And that's really my question. What is the government? Why is the government so afraid of the truth? Why is the government afraid of accountability, that it would go through such legal acrobatics to try to silence our voice? It's very clear online that there are government-sponsored, state-sponsored online hate, and that is directed against us. I think that's the newest thing from the 70s to today, is how you can use social media to make a lie a fact, right? So I'll give you an example. Two or three days ago, one of the forces sympathetic to President Duterte, one of the accounts said that I had Indonesian parents. And it just rippled because whether it was true or not didn't matter. It's not true, by the way. I was based in Jakarta for CNN for a decade. But here's the interesting thing. A classmate of mine from college, someone I knew in the United States, actually asked me if my parents were Indonesian because it had reached them. So a lie told in one country today, a lie told by one account, if amplified enough, can actually ripple like it's the truth, right? And that is the biggest challenge for democracies all around the world. How do you distinguish fact from fiction?
about a month ago, you wrote an essay for Time magazine, and you had it was headlined, "Facebook Let My Government Target Me, But the Social Media Giant Could Still Fulfill Its Original Promise." Your lead paragraph was, "My reputation and peace of mind were demolished by information operations on Facebook. It's a cautionary tale for the U.S." And you describe what researchers have called patriotic trolling, basically state-sponsored hate. Talk a bit about how that's affected you and the folks at Rappler.
You know, when it first happened and the time when we began to feel it, as early as July of 2016, we gathered data to understand it in August 2016, and we actually began something called hashtag No Place for Hate, this campaign. We were extremely naive in August of 2016. By the end of August, we had enough data that I actually went to Facebook with it, because it was really alarming to me. It was really using freedom of speech, inciting to hate against a specific target to silence them, right? And that's precisely the tactic that's going on now. We came out with a three-part series in October of 2016. I mentioned the dates because they're important. It was a long time ago. So we came out with that three-part series, and at that point, I got pummeled with about an average of 90 hate messages per hour, not 19, 90 hate messages per hour. That was the time when really it's psychological warfare, and I had to figure out, like, you know the way we were as traditional journalists, right, Bill? I mean, I had to think, am I doing the right thing? I went back over all of my facts. I made sure that it makes you doubt yourself at the very least and then waste your time going back to make sure that you're accurate. And then once I had the data, then I felt like I could see reality. Because when you see it, it is a systematic attack against journalists. And by January 2018, we could see the impact of this systematic online attack. There were two surveys that came out in January 2018, one in the real world, one in the social media world, and both of them had complete opposite results. The Pew Global Attitude surveys asked real people, do you trust traditional media? And 86% who were surveyed said they did, and they thought traditional media was, and this is a quote, fair and accurate in the Philippines. The second survey is part of the Philippine Trust Index. I mentioned this in that time piece. That survey only asked people on social media if they trust traditional media, and it had the opposite reaction. 83% said they distrusted traditional media. That is what concerted, systematic information operations against the target, against the voice for truth, against potential institutions or alleged critics. That's what it can accomplish.
Internationally, you've been recognized as one of Time's Persons of the Year. Congratulations, by the way. And it was so great to see you on New Year's Eve in Times Square on TV. You know, you're getting some well-deserved and some might say long overdue publicity about what you're doing with news. But how important is, for example, that outside publicity to what you're doing, to what you're able to do, to honestly, to your safety?
I think our best defense has always been a good offense, to shine the light. It is what journalists do, right? But I think the newest factor here is that when your entire population, when the Filipinos themselves are under attack, when the information warfare targets Filipinos, and it's really, truly a scorched earth policy, and this isn't the first country we've seen it, right? When your own public doesn't know what to believe, then the voice with the loudest megaphone gains even greater power. And that happens, that's President Duterte, the most powerful man since Marcos, perhaps more powerful than Marcos. He owns the executive. He has a supermajority, essentially owns the legislative, and he will appoint 11 of 13 Supreme Court justices by the time he leaves office. So to go back, best defense is a good offense. The international attention to this slide of our democracy into authoritarian style ruler, into dictatorship. That's helpful, but in the end, the polarization that technology has enabled, that is going on right now in the Philippines. We are in a battle for truth. And, you know, our ability to both survive as a democracy, survive as an organization, to find what journalism is like in this new world, even as we're constantly under attack, that's what's at stake for us. And I think, you know, I tell my team all the time, we know what we're doing is important. But at the same time, I also tell them, you know, we need to make sure you sleep, you rest, you go away from social media, because this is like death by a thousand cuts.
You have spent so much time developing journalism in the Philippines and a culture, really, of journalism in a space that is so eager for it. I recall some of the younger folks with Rappler over there with such passion, not only for telling a story, but for helping their community, their country, really. And the government's clearly trying to intimidate people, intimidate journalists. How are your folks holding up?
Well, I mean, there are always moments, right? I think we were all shocked a year ago. Think about this. This is only about 13 months. In January of 2018, the government tried to revoke our license. We continued operating. There was enough pushback from the judiciary that that case has been remanded back to the regulatory body, the Securities and Exchange Commission. But that was the mother case. That is both a civil and a criminal case. Since then, the government keeps throwing spaghetti against the wall in terms of cases against us. I faced five tax evasion cases in two different courts. I've had to post bail against those. But that tax evasion cases, all of those, stem from that same one investment vehicle. And they're saying that they're now treating the investment as income. And they're treating us as, and this is a direct quote from the legal documents, stock brokerage. It's a dealer in securities is the direct quote. So they're essentially saying we're stock brokerage, we're selling stocks to the public, which we're not. And that's the foundation of the tax evasion cases. Those cases are live. And then aside from that, there are other criminal. So, of course, this one where they arrested me and detained me for a night, cyber libel, again, a relatively crazy idea that will have huge impact if they find against us. I've posted bail six times in 2 months. We face nine-plus cases that are ongoing right now. And, you know, we're continuing. We just released a really an investigative report last night looking at what the state of the drug war. And we've pinpointed, based on numbers that the police themselves have released, that the epicenter of the drug war has moved out of the capital, perhaps too much attention. That's good. But it's now moved to another part of the country, and we need to keep the focus on it. We go back. Why do we do this? We keep doing it.
I know that you've got good legal help, but what comes next for you?
I think, you know, the easy part is to give you a soundbite answer, which is, you know, we hold the line. I say that all the time. But for me personally, you know, definitely getting arrested is something new. Bill, I've never felt that before. Although, you know, in Ambon, we were kind of thrown in prison for a night, but not really. We weren't arrested. But new experience. It's a new world. Trying to understand this new world. I actually, through all of it, through the legal and the security issues, what's fascinating to me is that so much is changing. It is a brave new world, and that's that dual meaning of what that is, right? And it's also a privilege to be able to be part of shaping what the future can look like, not just for Little Rappler, but for our country, and then to understand that our battle is your battle, right? It's a battle for truth. It's and holding these social media platforms, technology that has enabled this exponential rise. A lie told a million times becomes the truth. That was never possible before. How do we react to this now? And, you know, the people who have the power to do something about it are American social media platforms. Holding them, asking them, working with them to try to change this so that we have more, we have technology that is friendly to democracies, not to dictators. This is extremely important today. So there's lots of upside to it. When you ask me what's next, we continue understanding the world we're in. We continue doing our jobs. And I hope we win, right? We do this because we have to.
There is such a tremendous diaspora of Filipinos, Filipinas all over the world, including many here in Hawaii. And people are worried about what's going on back home. How would you characterize life in the Philippines these days? I mean, and compared to before Duterte, or compared to just, I don't know, whatever comparison you want to make?
You know, I've covered this country since the People Power Revolt in 1986, and I've gone through all the different administrations, the different governments, the priorities, and how our culture has changed. You know, like most Southeast Asia, when you release, it's like a pendulum swinging wildly. In 1986, the pendulum was released and it went back and forth. I remember all of our 7 coup attempts in the first year or so, and slowly it was starting to find stability and find the center. This is all new. I think what's different about this is I began to understand exactly how martial law in the 70s began. Because when I came back in 1986, I was asking, you know, it's not just one man. How can one man hold an entire country for 21 years? There's complicity in the society. And I looked at it that way because I was coming in from the outside. I offended some of my friends then because they said, you don't know the people who died to have our democracy, right? And there was a long fuse. Ninoy Aquino was killed in 1983 and the People Power Revolt happened in 1986. Today, it's extremely different. Everything is fast. That fuse is extremely short. It's seconds now, right? And I think what we're seeing, I understand it now, it's death by a thousand cuts. It's fear. It's the use of fear to make people silent. And silence is complicity, I suppose, in the harshest way possible, but I understand the fear. And that's wielded very effectively by the administration. So that's the biggest difference. And I think the key thing here is to continue doing the stories, to show the abuse of power, to show the weaponization of social media and the law against perceived enemies of the government. These are lies. They shouldn't be allowed to happen. And by doing that, just by the fact that we exist, I hope that that's enough, right, for people to stop being silent. We're not politicians. I'm waiting to hear from politicians. We are journalists, so we will continue doing our jobs. Now I have to trust our society will take the information we're giving them and do the right thing, hold our government to account.
We got a global cheering section. Maria Ressa, founder, CEO, editor-in-chief of Rappler.com, arrested last week by the Philippine government, out on bail. My friend, you take care of yourself, Maria.
Thank you, Bill.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll help dispel some of the fear factor around artificial intelligence and machine learning. We'll find out how one local company built a tool that gives high school students an easy way to train their computers for a specific task. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. March is National Women's History Month, and in coming days we'll be remembering significant women in our community. Today we note a famous police commissioner. Appointed in 1959 to Honolulu's Police Commission, this woman was later elected by her fellow commission members to become the first woman police commissioner in the state and in the United States. In 1970, she was named Volunteer of the Year by the Hawaii State Chapter of the American Red Cross. active in the Hawaii Republican Party throughout her career. She served in various party positions from president of her precinct club to district chairwoman. She was twice a delegate to national presidential conventions, part of the Nixon campaign in 1972 and the Reagan campaign in 1980. A woman of many facets, she served on the Citizen Advisory Committee for Castle Medical Center and was even a substitute teacher at Kailua High School. Today's quiz, can you name her? If you can, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Eric Schneiderwin from AARP. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Truth and Lies, a focus on Capitol Hill today, where President Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen's been testifying for hours. Here in Hawaii, different allegations of lying are touching a series of criminal cases. One result is a number of cases that have been transferred from the Honolulu Prosecuting Attorney's Office to the State Attorney General's Office because of conflicts of interest. Nick Gruby has a piece on this latest development in Honolulu Civil Beat. He joins us now on the line. Nick, the latest complication of the U.S. Justice Department's continuing investigation into public corruption at the police department, the office of the prosecutor, how unusual is this move, this transfer of cases?
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on. This is a pretty unusual move for the prosecuting attorney's office. So what I received from the office was a list of about seven cases that they have transferred to the Attorney General's office since the beginning of 2018. Four of those cases involve three grand jury witnesses or potential grand jury witnesses in the ongoing criminal investigation. The other cases involve, I think, a speeding ticket for another prosecutor in the office or some sort of traffic infraction. And another case involving two other people who were involved in a fatal car crash who happened to be related to the prosecutors. So we're talking about seven cases over the course of a little more than a year. What makes this even more unusual, however, is the fact that some of these defendants have been trying to get these cases out of the prosecutor's hands for upwards of 2 years. One of those defendants is Tiffany Masunaga, who is a central player in the indictment involving Catherine Kealoha and her younger brother, Rudy Puana. They are accused, of course, of participating in a drug trafficking ring and putting opioids into the community. And the other defendant is Albert Lee, a former Honolulu police sergeant who planned to go testify before a federal grand jury about Catherine Kealoha's potential links to a Honolulu businessman who is also a convicted felon.
And, you know, an unfair question, perhaps it's unclear, but on the timing, why now on the timing? As you say, this is the requests were made a couple of years ago.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And I think that what we can look at is the fact that Hawaii Attorney General Claire Connors recently asked Keith Kaneshiro to be suspended and basically removed from being operating in the prosecuting attorney's office while a criminal investigation plays out. Because as you'll remember, Keith Kaneshiro himself is a target of this criminal investigation. Now, one thing that happened recently with Mr. Kaneshiro is that he has received an attorney in a separate yet related impeachment proceeding that is ongoing. And that attorney, William McCorriston, had said during a press conference about a week or two ago that he expected some of these conflicts to be resolved soon.
But if also, if you're a defense attorney with basically any case that Catherine Kealoha had a role in prosecuting, I imagine that you're very attuned to these developments.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's one of the big questions that a lot of defense lawyers have been asking themselves is what involvement did Catherine Kealoha have, if any, with cases involving my clients? Now, of course, she was a deputy prosecuting attorney who was the head of the career criminal unit, which means she supervised several other prosecutors within her office. And the question is did she touch any of the cases directly, and was there any taint in those cases? As one of the lawyers I quoted in my piece said, that you need to pay particularly close attention to cases in which she might have had a personal or familial relationship with somebody involved with the case, because as we've seen, those cases are now under scrutiny from the Department of Justice.
Tracing those relationships, one of the keys going forward. Thanks very much, Nick Gruby. Thank you. Every day we bring you a reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. Today we featured reporter Nick Gruby. You can read Nick's story in full at civilbeat.org.
Two women want to buy a home in the same neighborhood. One's white.
We could easily get pre-approved for a mortgage up to almost $500,000.
One's black.
I was really sad and just like so defeated.
And it's happening to people of color across the country. They're missing out on home loans that white people are getting. On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This evening at 7.
After yesterday's broadcast of the Zocalo Public Square panel discussion on tourism in Hawaii, Gus from the Big Island called our talkback line to share this.
Have you ever thought of vetting people before they can come to these islands like New Zealand and Australia do? You have to have, like, resources and a skill and be a certain age, actually. They don't just let anybody go there. You got yourself a runaway Jesse here for sure. I mean, all the diesel in the air, all the sewage, the trash. Go check out Maui, man. You know, that's what happens when the golden goose gets strangled. Aloha.
Wayne from Honolulu wrote in with this. I wish the fortunes and identity of Hawaii weren't tied to tourism. Granted, there are other businesses in Hawaii that aren't tied to tourism, but the only industry in Hawaii that shows any growth is tourism. The best way to ensure tourism in Hawaii is sustainable is to seriously develop other industries and a workforce that isn't tied to tourism. Thanks for your feedback. Do you have any thoughts about the cogs that run Hawaii's economic engine? If not tourism, what other industries could we look to? You can always tell us what's on your mind. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We've been talking a lot about facts this morning. Here's a fact. Women managing motherhood and a career have a harder time in the United States than in many other countries. Now, that fact may not be news, but it's part of the focus of a new book by sociologist Caitlin Collins called Making Motherhood Work, How Women Manage Careers and Caregiving. Neil Milner's here with some thoughts on that in his segment, The Long View. And, Neil, she did a lot of field work for this project, interviewing 135 women in the U.S., some European countries, and finding some pretty significant differences.
Yeah, she interviewed mostly middle-class women who she said they're the canaries in the coal mine. If they have it bad, then others will have it worse. In countries Sweden, Germany, Italy, and the United States, all with different kinds of policies toward women and work, all with, and this is just as important, different cultural notions about women and work, and then looked at all of them. And what you suggested about the United States, let's start there. That's the starkest, the most simple, and maybe for most of you the most important fact. There is no reasonably highly developed country in the world, certainly none of these countries that she looked at, that has as weak a safety net for women and work, that offers fewer resources than the United States. Women in the United States are simply not guaranteed, or men, because they become involved in leave for child care and in paternity leave and all those things. We guarantee virtually nothing at a national level. There is no national policy. States vary on these kinds of things. There is no entitlement in most places to any kind of child care that's paid for the government. So you're really out on your own. Every woman in every country have certain kinds of stresses that they compare, but every one of them has more expectations and has more offered from the government than the United States does.
You know, she did an op-ed piece in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago and noted that the United States is the only country in the industrialized world without federally mandated paid maternity leave.
That's right, and that's really amazing because we're not only paid maternity leave, these countries, a number of these countries, Sweden is a good one, and I want to be very careful here to make sure that you don't just turn it off because it's Sweden, especially if you're conservative, right? Because she makes the point saying you can't just adopt one country's thing to another.
No bolt-on policies.
Yeah. But if you look at it by any objective measure, women and men in regard to family policy certainly have it better in Sweden than anywhere else. They have long periods of time where they can take paternity leave and besides which vacation time, mandated vacation time that you get in government mandates. We don't even have that here either. And so you're depending a whole lot on what you can come up with on your own. And one of the ways that this gets manifested, and this brings the cultural thing back in which I said, they're very different attitudes toward women and work. In Sweden, the Swedish women that you interviewed say, we don't understand this expression, working women. They work. There is no such thing as
the,
yeah. And so what Sweden has is a policy that recognizes a kind of broader community support, that is government support, for the notion that everybody works. Germany, it's a little bit different because there's still some older, more conservative gendered notion, although women tend to work there. And Italy, you're sort of off on your own, but there are different kinds of expectations there. What's happened in the United States culturally, and this reinforces the policy, is that not only do women have low expectations about what they can expect from government, they don't even complain about this very much. So much of the women's notions about, in this country, about work and taking care of the family, taking care of the kids, has to do with what they see as their responsibility, that it's up to them, and maybe their husbands, but it's up to them to figure out a way to make all of these things work.
And they turn that back to themselves in terms of blaming themselves.
That's right.
That it's their fault somehow.
That's right. And I want to, again, be very careful here. This is not about poor victim-oriented kind of women. It's about the fact that we tend to have relied for so long on the notion that you can make this work if you put this all together. And you and I were talking before about Sheryl Sandberg's book about Leaning In, which I think is a terrible book, because her notion is, if you were head of Google or whatever she was, you can make it work if you just have enough individual effort and initiative to go in. And these women, some of them believe that at some level that they should be there, that that's what they should be able to do, and they just can't make it happen.
That false promise. I was also reminded of there's a piece in the Atlantic magazine that came out 2012, Anne-Marie Slaughter. Is called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. Now, Anne-Marie Slaughter, she's an attorney. She had a top job in the State Department working closely with Hillary Clinton. And basically, one of her points was that this shouldn't be a discussion of gender roles. The focus should be on the work that needs to be done in raising children. And it's not about men and women and their roles. It's about the work that needs to be done.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's where Collins reminds you about Sweden. Mm. It is not a gendered role there. That is, there is certain not that we're all the same gender. But there is this notion that there is a broader political responsibility, first of all, for making families work. And that it's not about women's roles versus men's roles. It's about some kind of partnership that has become relatively culturally accepted in Sweden. There's some fraying now as they become more ethnically diverse. But that is supported by government policy, that because the government sees it as an advantage to the country to have people work together, they offer all kinds of other services. And we don't do that there. The other thing that's very interesting about that is that you hear these stories so many times among these women. American women work many more hours on average than their counterparts in these other countries that they're studying. And so there is this expectation that the workplace is like that, and if a boss gives you some breaks, that's wonderful. You're lucky you have a flexible boss. And what really saddens Collins, and she said this, the last place I looked at was the United States, and it made me sad and angry, was the fact that these kinds of things that women see, and I suppose their partners also see as what great luck that we have a good boss, are things that if you really want to have a policy that works, it does not depend upon flexibility, does not depend on somebody being nice enough to say you don't have to work 60 hours a week in order to get somewhere.
And apart from the whole argument that makes for a better workplace, and it's ultimately in the self-interest of the company to do that.
Right.
But beyond that, there's a political issue here for the United States. What are the politics of this?
Well, the political issue is this. We have crummy policies. But as Collins points out, in a federal system, if you want to have consistency, you have to have national policy. You can't simply adapt because we have these strongly developed notions about culture that you can't suddenly change. Germany has actually tried to make some fairly significant changes. It's been moderately successful. She said you have to take a piece at a time and you have to have what she calls radical hope. Let me just end by this. There are three groups in order should read this book. Politicians, for the first. Men, the second. And women should read it because it'll reinforce what they believe and so on. But it's their lived experiences. There's less for them to learn there, and there's more for these other groups to learn.
Interesting. Radical hope, too.
Yes.
Interesting. Thank you, Neil. Neil Milner, retired professor of political science, contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. You can find out more about this on our Facebook page, The Conversation, HPR.
Aloha, I'm James B. McCarthy, local singer-songwriter. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the program, we asked you to name the first woman to head the Honolulu Police Commission. The position had never before been held by a woman anywhere in the country. Olga Waterhouse was appointed to the commission in 1959, was a member until the early 1960s when she took over as the commission's chairwoman. Waterhouse was very active in the community, holding many different kinds of positions, active in the Hawaii Republican Party, even served as a delegate for the Nixon and Reagan campaigns in 1972, 1980 at the conventions. She's not just a political activist, also a strong figure elsewhere. Waterhouse served as a Citizens Advisory Committee member for Castle Medical Center, High Priestess of the White Shrine of Jerusalem, and Worthy Matron of the Order of the Eastern Star, a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, even a substitute teacher at Kailua High School. Olga Waterhouse passed away in November of 2009 at the age of 91, but her legacy of accomplishment, not forgotten, continuing to send the message that anything is possible. Didn't have a winner for today's quiz, but if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. When you hear the word hearth, what image comes to your mind? That's a question that's sparked by a new book, a multicultural anthology. It's subtitled A Global Conversation on Community, Identity, and Place. HBR's Noe Tanigawa was taken with the book and is here with some further thoughts.
Right, and I got a chance to talk with a couple of the writers and people involved in it. So interesting, because there's this idea that you know, with more of us becoming, with the expansion of communication possibilities through the internet and so on, there's also this corollary sort of disengagement from each other on a more personal level going on, you know, on a planetary basis. And so the idea was to ask questions about what brings people back together to a place that they feel comfortable with each other, even. Fascinating way to go about it. And they talked with immigrants, indigenous peoples, refugees, and got a lot of different perspectives here. I mean, is your hearth the spot where you belong, a place? Or maybe are you one of the wandering travelers, the people who circumnavigate this globe many times a year and need to find their homes in many different places? Well, award-winning writer Gretel Ehrlich is one of the people I got to talk to. She spent over 20 years living outdoors with Inuit hunters in Greenland. She said they'd often be traveling with these giant supply sleds, like 12 feet long, with 15 to 20 dogs pulling them, really heavy, making it across the ice. And she said it was way back in 1996 that the first dog sled started breaking through the ice and slipping down. And she said that's when her research on climate change started. So when she was asked about the concept of hearth, she got angry just thinking about how humans have fouled up our own planet. She says she's had it with this human-centered view of the world that just ignores the living beauty of this planet.
You know, one of my little theories is, like, we're not saving it for our grandchildren. We're saving the planet if we could save it. Let's just talk about caring about the place itself. I mean, that divinity, so to speak, is everywhere in everything. Just all sentient beings, you know, every bird, every mosquito, every, you know, and just being a part of the world and its wild diversity, and then you begin to care about it.
You know, just imagining ourselves part of this intricate web all across the earth. I mean, she says that just being interested and then starting to care is what maybe can spark the action that's required for us to.
You know, that's interesting in terms of it's almost like sharing a hearth, because a hearth can be a very personal or single family. You know, you think that sometimes is the center of a home, of a source of heat, of it's where the cooking is, it's where the cat sleeps, it's where, you know, Lincoln reads by the fire sort of thing, storytelling and family history and such. And yet you're talking about an expansion of that.
Right. And that's what's great about this book, is it brings so many different points of view together. And like, here's another one. I got to talk with Christine Yano, anthropologist, professor of anthropology up at UH Manoa. And she was saying she's really fascinated by the subject of hearth, because here in Hawaii, we do ask ourselves so much about belonging. You know, we're always kind of measuring, like, does time have something to do with belonging in Hawaii? You know, I've been here 8 years. Does that make me a kama'aina? Not sure.
Right. And how do we mark being local? Do we speak a certain way? Do we eat certain foods? And there are lots of those, right? But you have to ask the question, why does it matter? What does being local or belonging, you know, what does it get you? And I think that's really the more important question.
Oh, that's funny. You're saying, why do we want to belong?
No, but why is that question even raised in a context such as this place here? And, you know, what might the spirit of inclusion hide? What might be some of the violence that surrounds inclusion?
How's that? I mean, maybe the idea of belonging also does involve excluding some people, and we have to realize that as well.
When you draw a line to bring people in, you draw that line to have some people on the other side of it too.
Right, and you know, our concepts of how American, what does it mean to be American, how American are we? And here in Hawaii, we ask ourselves even more finely diced questions about belonging.
It's true, and belonging and local, and you can belong in a sense without being local. There's an aspect of localness that can be shared. There's an aspect of localness that, to a matter of degree, I suppose, in some ways.
I really liked going to the Neighbor Islands recently and talking to so many people who are Kama'aina here. I don't know how long they've lived in Hawaii. They weren't born here. But they have a sense of caring for the place that that was so important to see. And the point that Professor Yana was making here is that it's important to talk about these nuances of belonging now, because it ends up having political, repercussions and implications, all kinds of daily life kind of applications.
You know, those discussions are interesting, too, on a number of points. Some of the essayists, by the way, in this, Pico Iyer is always a favorite of mine. I know that he had some thoughts on
this. Exactly. Barry Lopez, again, yeah.
But the idea of healing is a part of this as well, in terms of a concept of hearth and in a concept of bringing together that which has been splintered a bit by society where we are now.
I keep coming back to where we are now. Mm. It's so great, Bill. You've lived the big news guy life. D.C., New York City, Tokyo. You choose to live in Hawaii. You felt something.
Yes, very much, and feel grateful to have felt that, and feel humbled to have that connection as well.
Well, I know maybe it comes down to hearth, the question of hearth, the idea of where can we live a meaningful life.
It's an interesting point that's there's going to be some further conversation about.
Yeah, we have a chance to talk about it all, guys. There's going to be it's actually a book launch and party and talk story around Hearth, a global conversation on community, identity, and place. Pualani Kanahele will be there with her, talking about her relationship with a live volcano. Gretel Ehrlich will be there, Frank Stewart also. And it's coming up Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, at Vaivai Collective.
Oh, that's a great space for conversation.
For talking
too,
about things like this.
Yes, absolutely. Excellent. The book is Hearth, a Global Conversation on Community, Identity, and Place. And, of course, the reporter is Noe Tanigawa. You can find her work at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In 2009, the Justice Department took a couple of hedge fund executives to trial.
In simple terms, it's securities fraud. It was charged in various different ways.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Spoiler alert, they didn't go to jail. Part two of Why Nobody Did, after the financial crisis, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
Friends from Great Britain, Ireland, and continental Europe tell us how Brexit is affecting their lives.
Conversations between people, between friends, between brothers, for example, have been very difficult, sometimes very fraught.
Here are smart ideas for combating poverty in rural Guatemala. And get tips for enjoying your first trip to Brazil.
I'd rather go to a bar with five Brazilian strangers than five American friends.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Sunday at noon.
That is the conversation for today. Up tomorrow, we hear from the Navy and the City Council on the future of the Red Hill Fuel Tank Storage Facility. You can tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Just call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. Here's the phone number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, Twitter at HI Conversation. Conversation will be back tomorrow with Catherine Cruz. I'm Bill Dorman. More of The Conversation coming your way.